The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
Today on The Cyber Show, Sin goes electric in bad company. Peter goes into reproduction in cyberspace. Kevin logos into the BBC via the internet. Jose sends a fake PayPal invoice. Wynn tries not to get a job. Ira points companies at puzzle pieces. And lots more. So here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
All.net's February monthly members forum will be on Valentine's Day, Tuesday, the 14th of February. If you love, you gotta come.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
Breaking news from The Cyber Show. Computer reports of viruses spreading worldwide were spread by computer viruses worldwide. The viruses were real, but the viruses were fake. News reports of the fake viruses were confused and claimed that the viruses were fake. The news was fake, but the viruses weren't fake, but the viruses were fake.
This is a segment we call Sin in America.
So we're going to start with Cynthia. I want to start with, you know, the early days of your career. How did you, you know, where did you go to school? What did you do? How did you grow up? And how did that turn into what you became next?
Interesting start. My dad was an electrical contractor, and in a suburban community in New Jersey where not every part of the neighborhood was, you know, good for young girls to be going into. My brother apprenticed for him as an electrician, and I wanted to apprentice, but because he was going into some rough neighborhoods, he was like, no, you're not going to, you know, come and apprentice with me. So I ended up sorting gear in the garage. But kind of got a chip on my shoulder about that. You know, what do you mean I can't go do what my big brother does? Eventually, at the age of 17, short version, I became a stage electrician. I was running light shows for rock bands. I was working everything from load-ins and load-outs at the arenas.
And your father figured that was a better environment than rock and roll shows are not exactly the 17-year-old girl place to be if your father is concerned about you.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm one of those few kids that had really good foundation from my folks, and they did that. But, you know, they weren't going to control me. I'm me, so... So I loved it. I was doing really well. I was actually independent by 18. My mom pulled me aside and said, please go to college. And I'm like, I'm going to be a union stagehand in the city. I was actually doing live power tie-ins up to 600 amps. I'd go into a panel with big beaner clips and just get the juice straight in. So I was pretty bold or stupid or both.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the latter. So when I was, when I was taking electrical engineering, I ended up, you know, it was 60,000 volts, you know, at a couple, however many thousand amps, but they had a cage. And I went in I was selected as the volunteer who would go in and plug in the lab. And I went in and they have these big banana plugs that you plug these things. Yeah, huge. And so when I went in, they said, you know, but before you connect anything up, let me just explain why we have the cage. The cage is not to keep people from getting to the electrical equipment. The cage is so that if you electrocute yourself, you won't kill anybody else as your body flies across the building. And then he said, so figure out what you're going to plug in first, but think about it. So that was my introduction to high power.
She was. I know. So we've obviously both lived through our own stupidity.
It's good training. You know, it's really good training when you're at risk and it's explained to you.
Yeah. Well, the first few times I was terrified, but you know, I managed to get through it, but it was hard work. And, you know, my mom made sense about going into college because I said, well, I could probably do that. I was a terrible student, by the way. I was barely ever in high school. I actually did go into college. I started in junior college, nothing advanced. You know, it was like community college. I started taking philosophy classes. And like, oh, I like to think, I like to argue, I like to write. And then philosophy rolled into a, or community college rolled into a philosophy degree with a specialization in Western religion. That seemed a little purposeless when I got out of college. So I went back, I got my library science degree because I love reading. If I would have stayed the course, I'd be retired in a gated community in Florida right now because I did start as a librarian. But then, and this is where I start getting closer to meeting you. As a librarian, I was also the youngest person in the building, and I started bringing the internet into the building. This is the early 90s. And I had to explain, you know, these are PCs. This is the internet. This is what it does. And I was just light years ahead of everybody because, again, I just had this fearlessness about touching tech and, you know, things with electricity that flew through it. I wanted to be involved with.
You know, I got my master's in information science from the School of Library and Information Science at the University of Pittsburgh.
I love that.
So it's, you know, and library science and information science sort of started together, right? And, mm-hmm. and you know, now computer sciences and people don't understand library science. The other thing is there's the archives and records management, which is a very interesting scientific field, which is closely related to those, and which mm-hmm. in many ways is more advanced than the other sort of fields of information technology, because, you know, they're doing records that are actually relied on for legal purposes. And they started understanding this stuff in the 1400s.
So. Yeah, right. The Alexandria Library. I agree. In fact, when I went to Rutgers for library science, because I was studying Western religions, I really wanted to go look at the Dead Sea Scrolls. I wanted to be an archivist, but Rutgers didn't have a program in that, but they did have this, you know, at a scope, I forget what they call it, the 700 series, you know, follow your own path, this new thing called internet. And so I was like, all right, I took all the reference classes. Like, I love those. I can't do anything with archiving because they don't teach it. So I'm going to do this internet thing. And like what you're talking about now with records management, I mean, these e-discovery people, when that first started breaking out in, I guess, the 90s, the 2000s, I said, that's just machine access readable code. That's a MARC record. That's a card catalog is what you're doing. But you just figured out how to charge $400 an hour to do it, where librarians are making like very little. So
you decided that was the field you were going to go into. Okay. So we're going to pause now for their 10-second break.
And now a word from our sponsor. Our next Angel to Exit monthly advisory meeting will be February 14th, Valentine's Day, at 9 a.m. Pacific. Our next All.net members forum will be at 11 o'clock that same day. To attend, sign up to our mailing list through thecybershow.co.
To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up. During this segment of the show, we talk to historical figures from the cyber world. So now let's talk about computer viruses in this context, because, you know, and it must be obvious to you, right? So you can create rings with these things, right? So essentially there's the rehoming of this thing has to do with going around the ring and finding the right place.
Right.
And then I don't know if you remember Core Wars, where you had multiple players.
I was at Bell Labs and the game was on all the time with Vic Visotsky and Doug McElroy. And then Bob Morris came in and he had the
senior.
Bob, that's not Robert, that's Bob. Robert's the junior. Bob came in and he had the ultimately devious winner that he completely destroyed the game because he now had something he could win every time.
Well, when you say he could win every time, was it the theoretic three?
No, it's in practice. I mean, they stopped playing the game because he was too good.
Before I ask you about the homing sequence version of that, can you tell me what his algorithm was?
I don't know.
You don't know? You couldn't tell us?
I don't remember. I never played the damn game.
Now, that would be one you should never forget. You know, the winning algorithm that caused everybody to stop playing the game. That's like, you know, the best chess player ever, right?
Yeah. Well, the game, it was basically a strategy that had 100% guarantee of winning. But the point was it destroyed the game completely as it was originally.
If you ran it against itself, who would win?
It would win.
50-50 probability, right?
Well, no, 100% to zero if you used his algorithm.
No, but if I come up with exactly the same idea and we both put it in our space, the question is who runs last? Well, it's 50-50 shot, right?
No, I think it's not that way. That was, first of all, this is a game that they were playing in spare time while they were developing BSIS, which was the Bell Labs 704 or 701 even operating system.
Yeah, all right, so it was spare time. All right, so my other question here is, suppose you developed a useful computational machine that was inherently self-synchronizing so that any code you put in it would self-synchronize and therefore it would always repair itself.
It's just, the idea of self-repairing machines was something von Neumann came up with many years ago. And
also self-reproducing machines.
Self-reproducing machines.
Which you did mechanically, right?
Yeah. I don't know. That's sort of a mythical beast as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you showed a design for it. I mean, I don't believe one was actually built.
Yeah, I don't think so. But
still.
But when you need self-reproducing, you need materials to make the new computer.
That's right. This is the fundamental of the mathematical definition of computer viruses is it's not just you have the sequence of code, it sits in an environment.
Yeah, right.
And the pair is what produces viral behavior, reproduction. It's not.
Now there was work at SRI when I got there with Waldinger. He was trying to get synthesis of code.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a whole field on its own, yeah.
Automatic synthesis. But that was not hardware. I mean, the idea of self-reproducing hardware is kind of devious.
But think about this. You know, with nanotechnology, you can actually build little mechanical things that can take things out of the environment and reshape them and assemble them.
Yeah.
So I believe you could, make a self-reproducing mechanical nanomechanical device that would, become a disease of a form. Right?
Well, I think you've got that in software, but doing it in hardware is
another I'm sorry. What do you think a cold is? That's a hardware reproducing
virus, of course. Yeah,
of course. All right. So, we're going to take a short break here. You start with Core Wars, and the winning strategy in Core Wars is obviously reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
And did you ever play Core Wars, by the way, Brett?
No, I did not.
So I believe it's an article in Popular Science or Popular Electronics that describes it. But you can write a Core Wars emulator pretty easily, and I think they're freely available. So if you want, we could play Core Wars. It's a pretty simple instruction set. But the other thing in that same time space before the stuff that I did on computer viruses was there's a game, the Game of Life, it was called, right? You're familiar with that one, where you put a bunch of black or white cells and there's a rule about what happens, right? If you have, three black cells next to a white cell, the white cell turns black, mm-hmm. and whatever the rest of the rules are. And in that environment, you can create shapes that move across the space. That is, they keep reproducing themselves at another location, moving around the board. And then you can create much more complex structures that do all sorts of fascinating things. And that's, another interesting computing environment, which can be implemented in parallel. You can imagine that in that time frame, that was part of, we're going to develop an operating system for a piece of hardware, but simultaneously, we're going to be exploring new instruction sets, simultaneous operation of multiple code in the same memory, taking turns and execution, developing parallel. All that stuff is, I think, fabulous, wonderful, and part of what I liked about that era of computing, and something that I think we could redo. I think we've narrowed ourselves so much that we're focused on these very limited classes of machines. And there's an enormous space of exploration that gets away from this structured approach to writing programs to solve specific problems and moves into the space of exploring the nature of systems and environments. What are your thoughts?
I agree. And I also would comment that I remember Steve Lipner gave a talk where he used the term eat your own dog food. So that exploration, while of you know, like playing games on a system that you're actually developing concurrently, I think is a great thing. It helps you understand things like performance of the system, security of the system, reliability of the system. And speaking of reliability, he mentioned self-managing, self-repairing systems. I remember in 2001, IBM was very much pushing the idea of autonomic computing. So, you know, that was very interesting to me that that was not coming from necessarily academia, but it was coming from industry. And,
you know, that's 40 years after they were doing that.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So all this sort of new innovation stuff, it's the same with AI. The vast majority of AI, you know, there was a guy named John Andreas who did essentially learning systems that evolved themselves. That was, you know, the other approach to AI when people are going at expert systems and these sorts of things. And that's sort of making a big comeback as well. And, you know, there's just so many of these things that were being explored early on that were fascinating in that realm. There, I can't even list the number of other interesting things. Cybersecurity and the accounting systems that accounted for usage of time acted to destroy the use of computers in so-called legitimate activities for games.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if you remember this, but, you know, you could get charged with a crime for playing a game on a computer and stealing the time, right?
Yes, playing Star Trek, the one where you had to use the keyboard, not the modern type of game. Yes, but yeah, it was actually a deterrent because people did. There was a monetary or other type of punishment that you would receive for having fun on the computer outside of your work role.
Yeah, and then what happened is there ended up being a partition. I don't know if you remember this or see it this way, the so-called legitimate computing world. Then there was the gaming world, which was always more innovative and always at the bleeding edge. And then there's pornography. So gaming and pornography, we're talking about not just playing games, but also gaming as in gambling.
Mm-hmm.
We're making innovation. Cybersecurity was trying to chase them down, and they were breaking through and breaking out of all those security methods. And also then, of course, evolving computing and all sorts of other things. So this fascinating tension between the people trying to lock it down and keep people from doing things and the explorers. And then the explorers, you know, called themselves hackers, right? And now the hackers are still associated with computer criminals, right? But they were the ones doing the innovation.
Yeah, that's true. And we earlier on in the interview, Peter mentioned the A2 paper. The formal title is A2 Analog Malicious Hardware. It was written by several researchers at the University of Michigan. And that actually raised eyebrows in the gaming community and just about every other community, because yes, we know that, you know, like with games, you can go computer-based games, you can go in and with a hex editor and access to certain objects within that are used by the computer game, you can actually give yourself additional resources, you know, tokens to do things. You can change the state of the game, but with a hack like the A2 demonstration by those folks at the University of Michigan, it showed that you can actually have a computing system running games and also could be running mission critical software, and you can actually trigger a Trojan horse through an analog set of components of that system. In this case, in that demonstration, through the keyboard, and then that actually activates logic, digital logic, to do something that the system should not do, the cybersecurity relevant. It just makes you feel like computers, there is no such thing as a secure computer or trustable computer.
There's
brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story.
Did you ever do training at the FBI as well, or? You know, I guess the FBI training, as I understand it, was separate from the other law enforcement that Fletsy handled. Is that correct?
Well, separate, but interestingly enough, we had like 6 classrooms set up with computers to do training for online investigations and whatnot. The Bureau at one point had like only 1 classroom. So they at one point did bring some of their people down to FLETC to conduct their training. My training, I did not train specifically at the FBI headquarters, but I did end up going on their firing range and had some real interesting times with some of my fellow cyber cops with throwing lead down range, so to speak.
I did one of those with Tom. We went through Quantico and did one of the shooting galleries and so forth. And that's a story for another day, but you do not want to be on the other side with Tom. And I mean, not necessarily as the criminal, but you don't want to be there as the innocent bystander with Tom holding a gun. Not a good idea. All right. So, Kevin, one other thing I wanted to cover, and that is you have this wonderful picture of the cyber cop and the term cyber cop. So where did that come from? And when did you first become the cyber cop? What happened after that?
Well, it was the early 90s. As far as logos and whatnot, I'd have to look back and see where I developed those or stolen them, whatever it was. But
I thought it must have been like a media thing, right? You got an interview or something and they created that, or did you create the logo?
Well, I completely forgot about that because interview-wise, I was fortunate back in 1996, I think it was, interviewed by the BBC. And an hour-long documentary called Inside the Internet. But I do like some of the tchotchkes that come with being a cyber cop.
One of those tchotchkes is, it's like a Daffy Duck. I guess I picked up at a cyber cop meeting where they had people doing searches and seizures. So when you do a physical search of a room, you need to identify all the electronic devices so that you can properly collect the relevant material. And of course, these are now concealed in all sorts of things, pens and shoes and, you know, almost anything you can think of. Well, so are those the kind of tchotchkes, or are you talking about all those things you used to carry around?
Well, I'm thinking tchotchkes in terms of things that I collect. But what you mentioned is very true. I mean, there are all sorts of devices that, you know, cyber criminals hide things in or through, or, you know. But I guess the story of what I did at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center was told best by a very dear friend who's passed away, unfortunately. He was a news anchor at the Voice of America. He put the Washington Post online. He was with U.S. News and World Report. In 1996, in a cover story, my dear friend Dick Sussman wrote, he said, when Kevin Manson first mentioned the term cyber cop at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, agents snickered. That's true. He went on to say, they're not snickering anymore. They're too busy trying to train cyber cops.
Yep, that's the truth of it.
Does this sound familiar to you, Chris?
Yes, it very much does, doesn't it?
the thing where they snicker until they gasp.
Right. Yeah, we're all moving down this path together, right? You know, it includes, you know, the internet. Everybody understands that now. And it includes all these things. You know, it's interesting that the first in the 11th, 12th grade in Canada, I went to an alternative high school, the Independent Education Center, and me and another student put together a school newspaper, and I wrote my first movie review, THX 1138. And my point is in that review is the same as a lot of the stuff today, is this is not a forecast of the future. You know, the cyber sci-fi you see is not a forecast of the future. It's really talking about current issues, right? You really think about the future and what it looks like. You have to accept the fact that the internet's here. You know, social media, you know, the human communications part of the internet is a bit of a train wreck right now. It's not going away. We're going to have to work our way through it. And so, yeah, I mean, a couple decades ago, people didn't understand that, you know, we needed actual police, cyber cops. And Kevin had to be the one to walk around saying, you know, in the future, we need to be doing this. We should probably start now.
The other thing that's just, it's so sympathetic of everything I see this all the time, not just for me, but for lots of other people, that you come up with an idea, you think through it, you figure it out, you explain it to other people, and they all are like, no, no way. And eventually you get some early adopters, you know, and then it starts to roll over. And then, you know, 10 years later, the same people who were saying, no way, are now saying, of course, I was there at the beginning. I'm saying no, but I was there.
Well, you know, when I first saw the internet, it was a Usenet connection, the Sea Change, a little company in Mississauga, Ontario. And the founders, my two bosses, had knew somebody, so they had a dial-up connection to upload and download Usenet and mail. And it blew my mind. You know, it was the first time I saw the internet. And it's like, oh my God, everyone in the world is getting on this. And even, you know, John and Michael was like, no, you don't understand. It's really educational and it's academic and so forth. It's like, no. Everyone on earth is going to be on this. And then shortly thereafter, you know, ran into the idea for a firewall, and found out somebody, people were already building those. It was so obvious. Everyone needs a firewall, everyone. And several, you know, instances early in those days, but, you know, one person, you know, with, you know, decades of experience, you know, telling me, no, you know, firewalls are for the Fortune 1000 and big government. That's it. That's the entire firewall market. Right? Yeah. No.
So Gartner in about 2000 or something declared firewalls are dead. And right. Yet every computer has one today and is likely to have one for the indefinite future. They're just built in. So it's right. Like, don't be ridiculous. So I think it's just wonderful to hear Kevin explaining how, what is it the Borg say, right? Resistance is futile, but they're still going to do it. And this is something I think is not going to change. I think no matter how far we go with technology, whatever the next new thing is, humans are going to resist it.
Well, right. You know, I think, you know, AI, you know, let me do some optimistic forecasting over the next couple of years. You know, AI is freaking a lot of people out right now. I think what we'll do is figure out what we're really good at. What are humans really good at? You know, I don't think what we're calling artificial intelligence today is scratching the surface of human consciousness. It's just, you know, doing a lot of the word processing and so forth that we do in our heads really, really, really quick. But people are still different. I look at the text that, you know, ChatGPT puts out, for example. It's like, okay, that might save me some time. And I would go back and I would put all sorts of human weird twists into it.
Well, I have to say that it does better than probably 70% of the so-called cybersecurity experts that I've experienced in explaining things. And that does not speak well for those so-called cybersecurity experts, because ChatGPT is nowhere near right. It just does it a lot better than the other people that aren't right.
Well, break it down. You know, you and I are quite experienced in that field. And I still have to, as I walk through things in my head, it's like, what am I missing? You know, give me a list or something else. You know, what we're seeing in AI right now is kind of like, you know, Arthur C. Clarke's last novel. I can't forget the name, but there was an artificial intelligence assistant, you know, to the main character. And that's where we're getting to. It's like, I could make the list already, but if I could just give it to an AI, so just remind me, you know, and you know, writing a one pager, a product slick, or a press release, it really is the same stuff all the time. You know, I'd be perfectly happy to press a button and have it just reprinted for me. And again, go back in and change it. And you can change it, you know, cut and paste, you know, to put your product name in a press release, for example. Or you can actually think about it. You know, say, that's the logic I want to have in there, but I want to have, I'm speaking to these people, so I'm going to change these words. And
we talk about this in the context of scams. And if you look at current scams on the internet, and, you know, in the show, we have a whole segment on that, and we point out the ridiculousness of it, right? I mean, just, you know, the sentences don't make sense and so forth. But if all you do is say, ChatGPT, I want to scam somebody out of $47,357 for shoelaces, it will come up with a script that is better than the current spam.
Right.
And right now, you know, statistically, it doesn't matter. You know, so you send out a million of these messages and two people, you know, fall for it. So now you can do this with ChatGPT, and statistically, instead of two people falling for it, probably 200 will fall for it. So it's a real amplifier for the cyber crooks.
If we can't figure out how to run it, you know, we can't have nice things kind of ever again. Or we figure out how to run it. And I
you know, some right. things I think we will just illegalize. But not yet. Right now, we're at the point where we can't even illegalize, you know, people shooting each other. So, you know, we worry about spam. You know, give me a break.
We'll be telling more stories from Cyber Cops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time, KMBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Our next Angel to Exit monthly advisory meeting will be February 14th, Valentine's Day, at 9 a.m. Pacific. Join the mailing list at a2e.co for details. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E.co.
Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. Here's an interesting little bit of fraud. This is another example of the false invoice fraud that's quite common. People send you an invoice, and you might assume that it's a valid invoice because it looks like a valid invoice, or you might not act on it explicitly and simply allow some automated mechanism to pay it for you.
Hello, TomEricKiwam67322@gmail.com.
It's an invoice.
Here's your invoice.
From?
Invoice from Jose Medina. 0004.
Sent for.
Jose Medina sent you an invoice for $699 USD.
And due on receipt.
Due on receipt.
You can pay now or over time.
Buy now. Pay over time.
There's a little note to the customer.
Simply select PayPal credit at checkout and enjoy no interest if paid in full in 6 months.
Of course, I didn't order any such thing from anyone. It's merely an invoice sent to me.
Seller note to customer. Thank you for your interest in our product.
And it's sent.
Your Norton 360 premium subscription will renew today, and $699 is about to be debited
from a PayPal account.
From your PayPal.
Obviously, I'll not be paying this one.
The debited amount will show within the next 48 hours on your PayPal activity.
Now, here's where we get into a little bit of a dicey area, because part of the message might be from PayPal or some other legitimate provider, and you really can't tell which is which.
Don't know this seller? You can safely ignore this invoice if you're not buying anything from this seller. PayPal won't ask you to call or send texts to phone numbers in an invoice.
Okay, but it doesn't say that they won't tell you to call a phone number if you have any questions about an invoice.
We don't ask for your credentials or auto-debit money from your account against any invoices.
So they've just told you that they're not going to have you contact them, and that they don't require any credentials, and that they're not going to charge you. And now...
contact us if you're still not sure.
So now we're not going to ask for any information, and you shouldn't call us, and there won't be a phone number and an invoice, and blah, 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 and contact us if you're not sure. But they just said, no contacts required, don't contact us, but contact us. I'm starting to get confused.
Please don't reply to this email. To get in touch with us, click help.
But of course, you're really not supposed to click on buttons from emails that might be illegitimate. So they're asking you to click on help. And then they tell you,
not sure why you received this email. Learn more.
And of course, the way you learn more is by clicking on another button in the email.
PayPal is committed to preventing fraudulent emails. Emails from PayPal will always contain your full name. Learn to identify phishing.
And of course, the way you learn to identify phishing is by clicking on yet another link in their email. Did I mention that it was sent to an email address where I don't have a PayPal account?
You feel this is an unauthorized transaction, or if you want to cancel the subscription, please talk to our service team at 1-808-556-5424.
And here's where the real fraud begins in this particular case. The sender would be perfectly fine if you merely paid the money, and that would be great. But what's more important is that when you call this number, you're talking to one of their fraudsters, and their goal is to get you to give account information. Oh, what was that account? What was the PayPal account? If they can get your password, that's great, and so forth. So they're trying to scam you into giving them the information they need to really commit frauds against you. But if you just pay the $700 or whatever, they'll be happy to take that money and then do it again. Did I mention that this is the same amount that I broadcast on a previous show about a fraudulent subscription? Did I mention this? Don't click on any links in any email like this, even the one that says contact us, because almost certain it'll end up pointing to a wrong place or a bad place. There are many other issues associated with these sorts of emails, and this one might indeed have been forwarded through PayPal or invoiced by PayPal, but it's certainly a fraud in any case. It's obviously important to check your credit card, banking, and other similar services to see if there are any transactions that you didn't authorize. This is especially important on debit cards. Debit cards, unlike credit cards, take money directly out of your bank account, and the guarantees provided by law regarding credit cards are different from those for debit cards. Generally speaking, if you have the choice, you should always use a credit card for any transaction because it limits your liability. Every week, we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books.
The Cyber Show is brought to you by Nuclei, at the center of it all.
Now, on to our next service provider.
Wynn, welcome back. How you doing?
I am still doing fine. I'm watching them put sod on my lawn when it's 30 degrees outside, but that's their problem, not mine.
Yeah, that's it doesn't grow very well when you put it on at 30 degrees, right? It should be warmer for the roots to go down.
I don't know. I don't know anything about that. So that's why I got a landscaper. You know, let them and my wife figure it out. Not my job.
Fair enough. All right. So after you were in the production, how did you get into the cybersecurity business?
When I left the record business, we moved from New York to California, and we had sold everything. So I was going to take some time off. And then 6 weeks in, I was really, really bored. I think I just turned 30. And I got to do something, got to do something. So back in those days, you'll remember, Fred, there was a thing called the classified ads in the newspaper.
Yeah, they still have the paper anymore.
And so there was this ad in the Sunday San Diego Union, and it had the word computer and peripheral. And I go, I know what that means. And I went for a job.
You're qualified.
And I think it was 81. And I didn't have proper interview clothes, so I wore sneakers, jeans, and the top half of my wedding suit.
Oh, so and you looked perfect for the job. They were like, oh, this is what we're looking for.
And I didn't cut my hair was really long and all that. And so I did the interview, whatever that consisted of. And they said, well, you know, you have the job. And I said, no, I don't want the job. This was a practice interview. I had never been on a job interview in my life because in the music industry, you know, you just kind of knew people and things happened. It was very, very organic in the New York music business. So this was a practice interview. And then they talked to me into it finally. And so I got involved with computers. But then in 83, one of our local sales reps worked for Western Digital. And he says, hey, how much you know about security? And I go, why? He goes, well, Western Digital needs a consultant. And I go, fine, I'll do it. And I knew nothing about security, nothing about anything, but sure, I can do it.
Hey, Mike,
and
same thing, right?
And so they had me examine this product. It was an old ISA plug-in board for PCs, and it was called Stop. How original was that? And fundamentally, you remember? Oh, gee, I didn't know. And so I got it, and I got the manual, and basically it was a Western Digital DES 2001A encryption chip, which was state-of-the-art at the time. And then there was some really crappy software with it, and they said, can you evaluate it for us? So I go through this whole thing, and I look at it mainly from a user standpoint, because the crypto's the crypto. I didn't even know what that meant, but there's a chip. Fine, cool. And I looked at it from the user experience standpoint and wrote a report for them saying, this is not good because you got to do this, you got to do this. And I made all these suggestions, of course, in hope of getting an extended consulting contract, which never came through. But it was that incident and then becoming exposed to the NCSC, the National Computer Security Center, which was the unacknowledged arm of the NSA back in the early 80s. Yeah. And that gave me the bug to get into security of some sort.
All right, Chris.
Right, you know, in our last win segment, we were talking about the mixed set of skills, you know, in this demographic of crazy old original cyber folks. And it's funny, you know, Win started talking about this, so I can say this: actually, putting the lawn down, you know, saw it down at 30 degrees is fine. It's perfect. Right? You get it down there, it'll warm up. It'll take care of itself. Because I landscaped my way through some college in the late 80s and got my first computer job and you know, failed my way upwards since.
To me, the thing that was most interesting about that, and I've seen this with Wynn time and time again, anytime you bring up something he doesn't know about, he says it right out. It's not there's no fake it till you make it. It's like, no, hey, that's just not my thing. I don't know anything about it. Let's, you know. So I leave that to people who know.
Right.
That's a tremendous quality that almost nobody seems to have that's as, you know, I'll call it serious and aggressive and effective as Wynn. Most people have this, you know, this thing they want to say, I know how I can do it. I can figure it out. And Wynn's like, no.
Don't know that one. Move on. Well, you know, two points on that. In the IRO segments, you know, he was talking about teams a little bit, right? And I didn't get the comment on that. And you know, your point about Wynn. Teams, you know, you need to be able to put together a team with all the right folks. And you're right. You know, Wynn is really good at that, you know, context switching, right? You know, my second point is, because what he's doing is saying, I want to not know this, right? Because it's a very important, you know, set of words in that order, right? It's not that I don't want to know. I want to not know. It's important for me not to have this in my head. I'm not going there. I don't want to understand it. I don't need to, for whatever reason. But you know, quite often that I've got enough things. I just don't need to understand that as well. And when you don't know it, you don't know it, right? You know, I have a fake it, you know, until you make it person, right? And I'm very open about that too, right? So you know, to have a good team of folks, you know, you have to have these balancing, you know, characteristics, some of which don't go together well, you know, not in one person.
So now let's talk a little bit about the next part of it, which is getting jobs in cybersecurity today. They supposedly there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of jobs available, but you apply to one after another, you can't even get an interview. And now look at Wynn's timeframe, where lots of jobs and nobody to fulfill them, you know, because nobody knew how to do anything. And he just shows up and says, I know what the words mean. And they say, you're hired. And I think it's fascinating that today the claim is that there's enormous openings and nobody to fulfill them, but yet nobody can get hired no matter what they say, no matter how skilled and knowledgeable and everything else you are. And at the same time in Wednesday, you know, the first interview, you don't know what anything about it. They say, you know more than anybody else, let's go. So there's something wrong here.
Well, what's wrong is that we are at a moderate maturity level in cybersecurity in the world, right? And it can look like a high level. It is not. You know, we are not done fixing, you know, my day job right now, you know, working in supply chain security, supply chain intelligence, software bill of materials, all this stuff is fundamental. You know, do we know where what software we have? Not really. Okay, got to figure that out. We haven't even gotten that worked out yet. At the same time, to your point about jobs, it's easy to say, well, I need these acronyms. I hire these people with these acronyms because it's all figured out and I'll be fine. No. You know, we are still, so it's not the frontier days when you can just do anything.
So it's our, but it's false, not a mature sense, either. Our false sense of maturity is what's bringing us here.
I like the phrase, yes, false sense of maturity, right?
Yeah, which as leads, opposed to false sense of security.
But the first one leads to the second one.
They go together, right?
Right, absolutely. No, we've got this really down well. It's like, by the fact that you say that, I know that you don't, right?
Well, yeah, right. Because anybody that really knows, yeah, no, we don't really have this down well.
No, what you say is, you know, here's where we are. You know, I am moderately comfortable that we've got most of the things taken care of. We got these backups. I think the company will survive. You know, that's a statement. Saying we've gotten this taken care of is a statement too, but it's not the one you're making. It's saying it's not taken care of.
So I was talking to the CEOs at my CEO's forum about this the other day, and it was fascinating. That's exactly the sort of thing that we hear. You know, they say, oh, no, we've got that covered. And I say, and, you know, these are, you know, people that I know and have worked with for a period of time, and they know me, and nobody's going to be pulling punches or anything. So I say, no, you don't. You know, you know how I feel about saying this is secure. You said, no, it's not even a word that we use. You know, at best you can say we've secured this, you know, but it's not secure. And then we had the same discussion about sort of a more fundamental of cybersecurity, and that is that nobody wants it. People say, oh, no, we want it. No, you don't. Let's get serious. I'll give you an option. You can take a vacation this year or spend the same amount of money on building up your cybersecurity program. Which is it? There's right. Nobody that says, forget the vacation. I won't take my family on a vacation. Let's spend that money on cybersecurity. No. The other one is, so you live in a safe neighborhood and it's a beautiful place and you have these beautiful picture windows, but you know what? It's really, I feel what's missing is bars. We need to put bars on these windows. Boy, that really makes me, no, nobody ever wanted bars on their windows. You put them there because you have to have them. That's how it is with security. Nobody actually wants it.
Well, right. You know, so the, you know, what people want when people are buying security, what they want is comfort. You know, they want to not think about security. They don't want to, you know, give them the morning and say, my security is really good. They want to go, oh, that's right. Security is really good. You know, once a month or something when it crosses their mind for some other reason. Right. You know, so we got to think about what people are trying to achieve. Right.
Compare that to the rest of cyber. Okay, because you and I know this. People in the cybersecurity space get into this horrible thing of everything's bad and terrible and the world's collapsing. And you brought me to, and I completely agree with you, the world's a better place today than it was before. And that's because of cyber. Things are great. And the rest of cyber, when it says, oh, you want a new iPhone? Yes. do you want to do this? Yes. Oh, do you want an account that does this for you? Yes. Do you want the chat GPT to answer your questions for you? Well, let's try it. Oh, that's cool. It works. Yeah, let's do that. It's all yes, except when you get to security where it's, you know,
Well, as we're always discussing, you know, we need to be at a maturity level where we understand what we're trying to solve, you know, the nature of it, right? And then try to find a way to solve it. And this is a funny one, right? You know, as the great Tom Waits said in one of my favorite songs, I'm afraid that if I exercise my devils, my angels may leave too.
How can you see the totality? Maybe that's something where cyber technology can really help in getting to that full set of facts and creating that balance in an independent way, taking out each of the individual perspectives and giving you the broader picture in the same way as it can tell you what the speed limit is.
Right. Well, right. You know, metrics in security, right? You know, this is something that you and I have worked a great deal on.
Yeah, but metrics and enjoyment. I want to do this cyber thing, right? I want to do collaborative music in the cyber arena with artists from all over the world. And we know there's timing problems, you know, that when we're trying to play together, there are delays and so forth. So how do we do collaborative music? And what are the risks of that collaborative music? How do we get that so that those metrics answer those questions? And not just for collaborative music, but for anything, whatever it is that I want to do. I want to find something fun to do today. Oh, let's go to San Francisco and do this. Oh, let's go to LA and do this. Let's go to New York and do that. Where do you go? How is it safe? So imagine now that this mapping function and this activity function where it knows what you like and enjoy, and it finds things that the group of people mutually enjoy, and it takes into account the safety and security considerations and turns it into a very positive experience, including in real time detecting events around you and helping to keep you from getting in trouble unless you want to be in trouble, in which case, go for it. It directs you the way you want to go.
Personally, I quite often like just, you know, do what makes you happy. I think that's a good, you know, moment by moment exercise. But when we're trying to actually advise companies, you know, and countries and, you know, politicians and so forth, and how you manage these things, how do you, you know, put a dollar value on or a security protection value on happiness? I think you can, right? You know, if you have happier customers, you have shorter sales cycle, you have happier employees, you'll have better customer employee retention and lower costs and greater, you know.
Well, yeah, that's all complicated. Chris, you know, my metric on this is easy. It's my fundamental philosophy of life is that the goal is smiles minus frown.
Right. But again, you and I, and a lot of our friends were chewing on these big issues all the damn time. We do it literally for fun, right? You know, because I would actually like to figure out what the answer to this. What do I say to someone in, you know, even a small business, but much, you know, global, a massive corporation. What can you say to the people at the top that will make the world a better place?
I think, and look, obviously we're notioning about possible futures, but imagine that phone that you have pays attention to smiles minus frowns. That is your real digital personal assistance. The job is to find out whether you're happy or sad and to help you get into situations where you're happier and fewer the ones where you're sad. And that's the whole purpose of it.
Well, I would load that app right now. Why not, right? I would load it on my phone right now. Yeah, get metrics, right? You know, I know we're squirreling on this one, but just think about that. What if you had some of this tech that would actually just pay attention to you personally and say, you know, you're probably in a worse mood than you think you are? That would be fine with me.
Yeah, well, and help you get in a better mood. Maybe turn on some music.
Right.
You know, some music that makes you happy so you start to smile.
Right.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Our next Angel to Exit monthly advisory meeting will be February 14th, Valentine's Day, at 9 a.m. Pacific. Our next All.net members forum will be at 11 o'clock that same day. To attend, sign up to our mailing list through thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977. Now, onto our next service provider.
So, Ira, last time we were talking about not quite influence operations, but certainly red teaming and social engineering. So after that, or you know, maybe you're still doing that, but what did you look at next? What are you working on after that to come towards today?
Well, so really at the end of the day, I've always been focusing my career on risk management, risk optimization. There's also the fact, and frankly, there's when I would do, so I'll break it into two parts. So directly out of the social engineering, people would say, okay, great, you did social engineering, now go ahead and give an awareness presentation. And it was horrible, because, or the results were horrible, and let me say that. And what I mean by the results being horrible was, I mean, you go ahead and there, everybody thinks, oh, here's what I did, don't fall for that. If it was that easy,
right. Then, the problem is the list is unlimited.
Yeah. The problem is, and so for example, you know, it's sort of like, I'm a classic example of this right now. I'm probably 15 pounds overweight. And what happened is I know I need to eat less and exercise more. And all I have to do is tell people to eat less and exercise more. Yeah, and that would be, you know, and it's like, but everybody thinks that's what would happen with awareness. It doesn't work. And I realized that a decade ago, but people were still selling, make the human firewall, regular firewalls suck. Why do you want a human one?
And, yeah, and, right. Because first of all, the best security expert in the world who knows exactly what they're supposed to do in almost every circumstance will eventually encounter one they don't know what to do. Part two is they can't get it right every time, no matter what. So if you have to get it right 1,000 times and one wrong lets somebody in and then they have access, you know, beyond that forever, then nobody gets it right all the time, period. Right. Mm-hmm. And then you're talking about how am I going to train somebody to still be nice? Because we still want the people to be nice to everybody they encounter. What if it's a customer instead of an attacker, right? We want them to be nice and at the same time be properly defended. And I think there just is no path to perfection there, and that we expect too much of people. And then the other thing is, I think that when you say, here's the finite instructions, here's how you're supposed to do it. If you can do it that way, why don't you have a program do that instead of trying to teach all these people to do it?
Yeah, well, the whole point that comes down to at the end of the day, I just look at security awareness as a piece of the puzzle. But the problem is, at the same time, if somebody doesn't fill out a time card, nobody ever says, oh, they're just, you know, you can't blame them. You know, somebody doesn't want to fill out, like I'm dealing with travel vouchers now.
Right. You still have to do your job.
I have to do my job, but it's part of my job to do it right. Now,
there's a cultural change since you were young, where people do not want those responsibilities. It's not part of the job for me to do that. My job is this. Leave me alone. You know, if I don't want to fill out a time card, you know, too bad. Right. That kind of thing. So people are less willing to participate that way. And so it's harder to get labor to work under those circumstances. So it's a cultural change. And now, you know, it's different if you're working for the military. I mean, if you get an order, you're supposed to do it, right? But that's completely different than, you know, working at the local university.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, nobody has a problem if they know that filling out a time card is part of their job. That's one thing. Now, you can say, for example, in safety science, there's a concept of what's known as a just culture. In a just culture, what it means is people are trained to know what to do. They are given the resources to do it, and they're not given circumstances which makes it difficult to do the right thing.
Right. Now, that's right. The creating that whole environment where, so now let's get to the core of this, because at the top level of most enterprises that I've encountered, they don't have a well-defined duty to protect. So at the top level, they haven't determined what they're supposed to do. And if you don't know what your duty is, how can you do it?
Exactly. But the principle is there's so many things that are like straight up. Now, somebody's saying, and there's another aspect to this as well, because in general, when you start looking at the statistics, probably about 5% of the people are caused 99% of all the cybersecurity and the damage related to cybersecurity incidents.
Yeah, the consequences, not right. The incident.
And it's this small group of people that are creating the most damage. Now, if this group of people, if you have somebody who happens to be in something like accounting, somebody that is dealing with PII, you know, works in human resources or something, and they are regularly dealing with this and they are potentially the most vulnerable, yeah, maybe they should not be in their positions.
Again, we're at a maturity level in all of information technology where we have built this global system to send
people links to click on, and we're trying to tell them not to click on the links. Don't use your business tool email to receive emails that, you know, for 99% of the average folks will look perfectly fine, like the ones you get all the time, and click on the links that you need to click on to do your job all the time. Don't.
No, instead, spend 5 minutes looking at each one to figure out whether there's some URL or something you don't understand that might be wrong, but you can't tell anyway. Right? It's just it's not going to work, right?
Oh, yeah. Hover your, you know, tell every single person working in every office in the world, you know, much less in your company, who, you know, not to hover, you know, they have to hover the mouse over the text in the line before you do. No, 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 that's not.
It's just not, no way, right?
No, it's not going to happen.
But the other thing is, if you can explain what I'm supposed to look for and what I'm supposed to see, why don't you write a program to do that? Because I guarantee you it's easier to write a program than it is to try and explain it to most of the people I deal with. And furthermore, if you can't write a program to do it, why do you expect that person's going to be able to figure it out?
Right. And not just that person, every person.
Yeah, I can. That's right. It's not just that one can do it. Everybody has to do it all the time.
All the time, yeah.
Right, with no mistakes. And that sounds like a computer task to me, right?
I would, yeah. I'm guessing, well, yes.
Now, the limitation, of course, is natural language understanding. And so, because computers aren't that good at it, but as you see in the AI technology, computers are probably actually better at it than most people. And if you look at the indicators of most of this spam and these frauds, these indicators are pretty clear. It's just not that hard. And like, we do this every week, right? We have a segment of the show that talks about this. And it says, oh, look, the from address from supposedly a commercial bank in the United States is a Gmail address, and the reply to is America Online. I mean, is that really how your bank talks to you? No. You should never see anything like that. It should all be taken care of.
Yeah, if anyone wants to see the trigger levels, you know, that you know, drive fixes. You know, I don't know what the fix to this one is, you know, that we're talking about in particular, but, you know, I remember back in the day when everybody, you know, particularly people with way more experience than me, which was everybody, said, you know, we basically can't have online banking until we fix the thing. You know, got to make sure that it's 100% before we can have online banking. And it turns out the banks say, okay, we can survive this percentage of screw-ups and write it off. You know, it's just a cost of doing business, right? You know, right now, apparently, we can put up with this much screw-up in this area. But it's
pretty painful at this point.
It's too much. I think we're at the triggering point. I think anybody that can develop something that allows people to do their jobs and avoid this sort of, you know, it can't be this easy for the criminals forever. You know, it's got to get better.
Well, there's another thing that always bothered me, and that is that we don't tend to arrest them, right? So, you know, we treat little crime as not important, but as you may recall from New York City, when they started arresting people for breaking windows, they cut down on all sorts of other crime because people realized they were going to get caught and punished, so they didn't do these other crimes, and they had fewer broken windows, so it was a nicer place to live. And I believe that there is, I don't think deterrence quite the right word, but let's just say a social improvement effect. When you get caught as a youth doing something bad and you get punished for it, not necessarily go to jail for 5 years, but you got caught, you got punished, you're going to be afraid and you're not going to do that anymore. And I think most people have done something wrong in their life, encountered a negative associated with it, and backed off of doing those things. And that there are some people who have done the bad thing, have been slapped on the wrist and said, don't do that again, and have gone on to do more bad things and not gotten caught. And that's how they learned to do more and more of it, worse and worse. And there's something in the social environment that we live in that has to change in order for this to change.
Well, you mentioned the small, and again, you know, try to keep on topic of the show. If, you know, we're talking about cyber and how cyber is, you know, can or perhaps change things. You know, the you steal $100 from someone who has $200. You know, that's an individual human being, a citizen of your country. And it is as big a crime, bigger, you know, than stealing, you know, $1 million from someone who's got a billion, right? You know, that's small crimes aren't small, right? But, you know, our process is too cumbersome. You literally can't take every, you know, small dollar amount, even if the impact to the victim is large. and process it the same way you do with some enlargements. We need to fix
that. This is one of the things that we learned about crime. And, you know, there are thresholds beyond which governments of different levels will not go after a crime. And so one of the things that the criminals learned is what's the threshold. So, you know, if you're under this $5,000 threshold, you only steal less than $5,000, you're not going to get the feds coming after you unless you do it in high enough volume and you get enough complaints, or you do it to the wrong person.
$9,990, right? You know, under $10,000, money laundering, great number right there. Yeah.
Well, it's still money laundering, but the threshold for detection is lower.
Right.
So understanding these thresholds allows people to get away with crimes below the thresholds. And all you need is a little bit of randomness in those thresholds so they get caught every once in a while. And then guess what? It happens, right?
Yeah, Pavlov would take effect.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Sin cops out and stops looking for leather work. Peter rushes into a meeting and comes out a mortician. Kevin names more names and goes global. Win goes anti-viral. Ira claims you can stop stupid system designers. And lots more.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.